Well, the last time I spoke from this pulpit, there were four people in the congregation. It was 1959, and the four people were judges in the annual sermon delivery contest for the Harvard Divinity School students. I won first prize. Then I found it was for the most improvement. We'll see. Thank you for asking me to speak. This year is the 50th anniversary, as you know, of the voting rights drive that centered in Selma, Alabama, and of the infamous Bloody Sunday on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. On the evening of March 7th, Sunday, TV news had shown to millions of Americans across the nation the hatred and the violence faced by African Americans who were seeking their fundamental right to register to vote. Though the Civil War had been over for 100 years, the Constitution had been changed to allow all persons to vote in 1870 for black males, in 1920 for all women. Across the South, practices had developed which effectively denied African Americans the right to register to vote. Cynical and arbitrary practices mostly directed by the whim of local registrars. March 7th, crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge, heading from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, state troopers and sheriff's deputies, I'm sure some of you remember, had used billy clubs, cattle prods, whips, horses, tear gas to disperse the peaceful marchers, ordering them to return to their homes and their churches. How many of you, by the way, remember seeing those television images of that? A fair number in the congregation. Nobody was killed that day, but scores were injured and even hospitalized. And the 23-year-old John Lewis, one of the leaders of the march, now a congressman, had his skull fractured. It was a painful, tragic page in American history, showing the world the racism which permeated, inflicted our society. James Reeb, Orloff Miller, and I, all Unitarian Universalist ministers, were attacked during the 1965 voting rights drive, but not on March 7th. We had responded to Dr. Martin Luther King's call for clergy of all faiths to come to Selma and to protest the Bloody Sunday violence. We were three among hundreds of clergy who arrived on Tuesday, March 9th. Prior to that March 9th, I had scarcely known Jim Reeb. I knew Orloff Miller better. I learned later that Jim had come to Unitarian Universalism from a traditional Christian background. In contrast, I came from parents who had been Unitarians since childhood in the Boston area, and my father, a Unitarian minister, who served over 50 years. In 1965, I was minister of the Unitarian Fellowship in Berkeley, California. When I saw the faces of, when I saw the TV news of Bloody Sunday, I was among millions of Americans shocked by the violence and racism. On Monday, I heard news that Dr. King wanted clergy to come to Selma the next day. My first thought was, that would be good to go. I'd like to go. But I really didn't have the money for airfare. so I dismissed the idea. But that afternoon, friends in the congregation called me. "We will pay for your airfare if you want to go." My excuse was gone. I simply decided to go. It seemed the right thing to do. I told my wife and my four-year-old daughter that surely I would be safe with all those clergy coming, present, that were going to be there, and the sheriff deputies and police were not going to attack those clergy. Some airplane engine problems en route delayed my flight, so when I arrived in Selma, the clergy march had already taken place across the bridge and returned to the front steps of the Brown AME Chapel. Addressing the marchers, Dr. King asked everyone to stay overnight if they could, go to dinner, and return to the chapel that evening. I looked around and saw, among many Unitarian Universalist ministers present, James Reeb and Orloff Miller, all of us white-skinned. The three of us went to a black restaurant, which that evening was full of voting rights supporters of all races. And after dinner, we began to walk back to the chapel, but quickly we saw three to four men approaching us from across the street, shouting angrily at us. One man carried a club. I don't know whether it was a baseball bat or a pipe or what. I looked behind and saw, just as they came up to us, saw a man swing his club hard, hitting Jim Reeb on the left side of the head. One blow. Orloff and I were also attacked, but not with the clubs, and we weren't hurt significantly. The attackers fled within a minute or so. Jim had fallen to the ground and was babbling incoherently. We went to help him. There was no blood, so we decided to help Jim to his feet. We weren't sure whether they were going to come back and attack us or what. And walked Jim around the block with his arms across our shoulders, him between us, to get help at the Boynton Insurance Agency in the black community. From the Boynton office, an ambulance drove Jim and us to a black infirmary where a Dr. Dinkins examined Jim. As I was holding Jim's hand, he squeezed mine harder and harder and harder as his pain increased. We saw no blood. It turned out there was internal bleeding with a badly fractured skull. Then suddenly his hand went limp. Jim went unconscious. The doctor, meanwhile, phoned the University Hospital in Birmingham seeking admission for Jim's serious injury, it being more serious than could be treated in the facilities in Selma. With all of us in the ambulance, we had a flat tire just outside of Selma. And then the radio phone in the ambulance didn't work. And a car full of white men pulled up behind us on the two-lane country road. I don't remember any other cars going by, but the thoughts were, was this all a conspiracy? We decided we couldn't try to change the tire on that country road with the men waiting behind us. Instead, we turned around and drove back on the rim of the wheel, the flattened wheel, to the edge of town, where our driver could phone from a radio station where he'd worked, seeking a substitute ambulance. Orloff and I were terrified at what might happen to us. This was just a few months after the bodies of Schwimmer, Cheney, and Goodman had been found in a ditch in Mississippi. Mississippi Burning is the movie, if you haven't seen it. The men in the car behind us also turned around, following us back to the radio station. They parked beside our ambulance, got out, and walked around our car, occasionally knocking on the windows and uttering threatening words. The substitute ambulance finally arrived. Orloff and I just realized at that time, gosh, we have to get out of this ambulance and take Jim's body on the gurney over to the other ambulance. What were they going to do? What were those men going to do? As we did so, one of them men came up to me and said in a distinctly hostile manner, "Hey, what's happening here?" I replied simply, "Please don't." I was frightened. In fact, the men did not attack us. We finally drove on to Birmingham. Meanwhile, from the infirmary, we had phoned to the Brown Chapel to inform someone of what had happened to us. Dr. King informed the crowd. Three Unitarian ministers had been attacked, and we were in an ambulance en route to Birmingham. Upon arrival in Birmingham, the hospital staff, of course, took Jim immediately into their care. He was still alive. Orloff and I were faced with reporters and FBI agents asking questions about the attack on us. It was after midnight before the questions stopped. The next morning, we saw that President and Mrs. Johnson had sent yellow roses for the Reebs at the hospital. Marie Reeb and Jim's father had arrived to be with Jim, Marie being Jim's wife. While the medical staff was attending to Reeb, Orloff and I again were interviewed by national news reporters and offered in-person condolences by high-level members of Dr. King's SCLC. James Reeb died approximately 36 hours after the attack on us. President Johnson provided government planes for Marie and Jim's father to return home. Though the bloody Sunday events received news coverage, the attack on us and Reeb's ordeal in the hospital generated a great deal of publicity. Thousands of people attended mass meetings in Boston, in Washington, in New York, in Chicago, San Francisco, and so on. I was told recently that 80 U.S. embassies around the world, people gathered to protest the attack first, and then following his death, to grieve for Reeb. A memorial service was held for Jim in Selma on Monday, March 15th, in the afternoon, with Dr. King giving the eulogy. Meanwhile, President Johnson paid a great deal of attention to the attack on Reeb and to the political opportunity that it offered. He decided that this was now the time to address Congress and the nation and urge passage of the Voting Rights Bill, which would outlaw poll taxes and literacy tests, the barriers that had been used to keep blacks from registering to vote across the South. Johnson spoke to Congress and the nation on Monday evening, March 15th, just 5 days after Jim's death. He asked Dr. King to be present for the address, but King could not be there because he had promised to give the eulogy for Reeb's service that same day in Selma. In his address to Congress, President Johnson referred to the events in Selma and noted that sometimes history and fate create special events that are turning points in man's unending quest for freedom. Such, he said, was the case in Lexington and Concord, and in Appomattox, and so it was last week in Selma. And one good man, a man of God, was killed. President Johnson thus singled out the death of James Reeb in his moving call for the Voting Rights Act, which would, in fact, prove to be a turning point in American and world history. I've been told by a television producer who did research at the President Johnson Presidential Library, research that was fact-checked by the New York Times, that the records show Johnson initiated or received 50 phone calls in those few days, three, 4 days, concerning James Reeb. 50 phone calls. Now, ironically, Johnson's address mentioned nothing about the death of Jimmie Lee Jackson, a young black man who was shot by an Alabama state trooper in Marion, Alabama, in February, just a month before, 3 weeks before, in 1965. It was Jackson's death during the voting rights rally that prompted the Selma to Montgomery march, which began as an effort to honor Jackson. It's also evidence of the racism in our society. That while Johnson had 50 phone calls about Reeb, a white man, he had none regarding Jimmie Lee Jackson. I know little about the everyday activities of the U.S. president, but it strikes me that 50 phone calls on the same subject in 3 to 4 days must be highly unusual. The men who attacked Reeb, Miller, and me were arrested in Selma within 3 days of the attack, charged with murder. They were released on bail. Orloff and I returned to Selma several months later to testify at the grand jury hearing, and then by year's end at the murder trial. The three men were found innocent by an all-white, all-male jury. Remember, juries are drawn from the roster of registered voters. The defense argued that voting rights advocates had deliberately killed Reeb in order to create a martyr for their cause. To this day, no one has been convicted of Jim Reeb's murder. One of those charged is still alive, Duck Hoggle, and still lives in Selma. I've been to Selma twice to help dedicate monuments to Jim Reeb. There's a substantial granite monument in front of the old Depot Museum in Selma, and 10 years ago, we dedicated a historical marker at the site along the sidewalk where the attack took place on us. The Women's Auxiliary of the SCLC was responsible for creating and installing that marker. In November 2008, the year of the election of Barack Obama, a few days before the national election, it occurred to me that the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, the UUA, might send yellow roses, as did President and Mrs. Johnson in 1965, to the family of Jim Reeb. But I had learned years before that Marie Reeb was so upset about the death of her husband, she had wanted to put it all behind her. She had moved to the West and had remarried. So I sent an email to their daughter, Anne, one of four children, with whom I'd had some contact, asking whether it would be okay to send the yellow roses to Marie and her children. It was my idea that the roses should arrive before the election results were known, to simply honor their role in America, simply having an African-American candidate. I wasn't sure, though, that the gesture would be appreciated by those who felt the hurt so acutely. A couple of days later, Anne sent me a message saying the family had talked about it, and the answer was yes, the roses would be welcome. And just after the election, we received an email from Anne that said, "Dear UUA friends, on behalf of Marie Reeb and the Reeb family, I wish to thank you all for the beautiful yellow roses you sent to each member of the Reeb family in memory of our beloved husband and father. We feel so very blessed to witness the incredible election of Barack Obama. From the marches in Selma to this amazing moment, in history, I speak these words with tears in my eyes. My heart is at peace forevermore. Thank you for your kindness." and reap. Overall, the Selma experience has been very important in my life. Over the last 20 years, up until this 50th anniversary year, I've given many talks on this, what my experience is there, especially to high school students, concerning the events in Selma and my participation in them. I've probably spoken to nearly 10,000 students in all. In addition, a CNN documentary titled Murder in Selma has been broadcast at least 5 times, sometimes globally. My daughter, Marika Olson, produced that program in 1998 when she worked at CNN. She had called me saying, "Dad, you and I are going back to Selma, and you're telling me the story of what happened." Since January this year, I've spoken frequently and been interviewed for CNN, ABC, Al Jazeera America, Al Jazeera English globally to 250 million people, the New York Times, the New Republic, and many other media outlets. And now, here, where I received my divinity degree 56 years ago. I'm particularly grateful to have the opportunity in the context of Selma of urging people, whenever you see an instance of injustice, to take a stand, speak up, do something, do the right thing. You never can know what may come of your decisions to do something. In my case, I tell them, by a series of seemingly insignificant events, like deciding to go, eating together in that restaurant, walking on a different side of the sidewalk from Jim Reeb when the attackers approached with the club, I have participated in a tipping point in American history. And I'm here to tell others. The same possibilities apply to the actions of all of us today. Selma continues in my life. I recently returned there for the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Drive, and I invited the Reeb family, including Jim's widow Marie, who had never been to Selma before. She'd not been there in all those 50 years. And all 4 of their children, and many grandchildren, plus Orloff Miller, Jim's and my companion 50 years ago, and his son, and my daughter, amid some 80,000 people, all the speeches and all the walking over the Edmund Pettus Bridge, our families had 2 hours together in a private dining room to share a meal and talk together about our experiences a half century ago and since. For many of us, it was our first time together. And it was a profoundly significant time for sharing the tragedy and the good which had come from Jim's death. Over the years, there has been for me an increasing discernment of the meaning and what I can do further. First, there's the realization of the changes since the Voting Rights Bill was passed in 1965. In terms of political empowerment, before 1965, across the South, there were only about 200 black elected officials. By 1975, 10 years later, there were more than 2,000 blacks in office. I have no idea how many today. But today we have Barack Obama, and who knows how many other black office holders. And I know today that there is a pushback against registration. Without going into details, I do believe that with effort, with us doing something, saying something, speaking up, those against black empowerment will not succeed. On a personal level, though over the last few decades I've been privileged to befriend well-known people in the civil rights movement, at 81 years old, I know that I have failed in reaching out enough, and I'm now trying to do that more. I believe that personal, one-to-one social contacts are a very important part of transforming our society. That building trust is not just a matter of changing government policies or corporate practices, but those changes must be coupled with private, individual efforts to simply get to know, to sit down and talk, to invite people to dinner, to have lunch in the workplace, or to ask deeper human questions in our casual conversations. At a very simple level, if you ask someone the question, "How are you?" and they reply, "Fine, thanks," you could go deeper, like simply, "What makes it fine?" That'll get you deeper. I've also decided to stand more frequently, stand in solidarity. That's really what we did in Selma in 1965 and this year in 2015. And last year there was a Moral Monday in Asheville, North Carolina, where I live. And 5,000 people came, an extraordinary number for the population of that city. And in Raleigh last year, I was there with 80,000 people who stood. From my experience, Selma experience, I'll say it again, don't be a silent witness. Whenever you see injustice, speak up, take a stand, be in solidarity. You never know what may be the outcome. In my case, I now know that at one time, holding Jim Reeb's hand, I was there at a tipping point in American history. I'll conclude by offering a context of awe and mystery. Harlow Shapley, a Harvard professor of astronomy and a Unitarian, by the way, wrote a book called Of Stars and Men, published just about when I began in the ministry over 50 years ago. He wrote in that book something like, given the story of creation, from dust to stars, over zillions of years to planets, to the planet Earth, to the first beginnings of life, to human beings, to our advancement of knowledge, to the telescope, to the Hubble telescopes. He didn't know of that, but to the Hubble telescopes and now the many successors to the Hubble. He said, I'll never forget it, human beings are the stars' way of learning about themselves. Human beings are the stars' way of learning about themselves. I simply cherish that idea. It's been a significant gift for my life's journey. From Professor Neil deGrasse Tyson, he says, we are made from the stardust of creation. I feel, these are my words, I feel that somehow there is justice and love built into creation. I choose to feel awe before the mystery while trying to be. In solidarity with justice and love. Thank you very much.